It's the Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. From time to time, we check in with our pals at the AV Club to help us find the diamonds among the quartz in the world of pop culture. Joining us this time around, Nathan Rabin and Keith Phipps. Gentlemen, welcome back to the Sound of Young America. Always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Keith, let's talk about the new box set of Apple Records recordings. This is the record label made famous, of course, by the Beatles, but also home to a number of other artists. In fact, I just the other day interviewed Ronnie Spector and played a great record that she recorded for Apple Records. Let's hear a clip of My Sweet Lord as recorded by Billy Preston. So, Keith, this is a very interesting and specific niche of the history of popular music. What did you really like about it?
Well, you know, I'm still digging my way through all 17 discs of it, to be honest. I think it's just such a you know, what I've heard is kind of is there's sort of the results are kind of odd. I mean, Apple was formed toward the end of the Beatles' existence. And what you have here is kind of the children of divorced parents. And the label kind of carried on for a little while after the band. And it didn't necessarily have an identity beyond the Beatles or one of the Beatles or some pairings of the Beatles like this. So you get, you know, amazing classics like Badfinger's No Dice and Straight Up, these cornerstones of power pop and interesting albums by a singer named Mary Hopkin that everyone liked and had a few hits. And Billy Preston, who's, of course, was one of many fifth Beatles and also recorded a few albums for them. But you also get the Radha Krishna Temple. You get James Taylor's first album next to things like the Radha Krishna Temple recordings.
Though it does kind of invalidate the whole project that does not have Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Heart Club Band, the movie, the soundtrack. Just because it had nothing to do with the Beatles and came out many, many years later. That to be pretty, pretty problematic in its own right.
It was actually on Casablanca Records, if I'm not mistaken.
That's true.
Nathan Rabin, let's talk about one of your, we'll say, pseudo-colleagues at The Onion, Maria Schneider, who for many years has written this character for The Onion called Jean Tisdale, who is, I don't even know how to describe her. How would you describe the sorry sad sack that is Jean Tisdale?
Well, she's The Onion's human interest sort of columnist. She kind of writes about, you know, sort of goofy day-to-day sorts of things. And sort of underneath this sort of very cheery, sort of banal facade, there's just this agonizing sadness. Sort of the column is about sort of the everyday tragedy of life. So it has kind of a, there's a review on Amazon, they refer to it as sort of, you know, deep despair with kind of a candy-coated shell. And that's definitely sort of something that comes out a lot fuller in A Book of Jean's Own, which is the first Onion book to be an actual comedy book and not just straight-up news reprints.
Keith, let's talk a little bit about one of the greatest films ever made, Metropolis, which is out in a new version on DVD. Now, because this film was made so early in the history of film, it has been released and re-released in about a dozen trillion different versions featuring different footage and different types of transfers and different remasters and so on and so forth. What's special about this new version?
Well, it's quite watchable. The first time I saw Metropolis was on a VHS tape I bought from Kmart, which had no soundtrack to it whatsoever. And I think every other frame seemed to be half black and half white with some blotches movie in the middle. So this was a, you know, this is a vast improvement over a version of the versions that most of us have seen over the years. They found almost a half hour of additional footage, like kind of somewhere in the vaults in Buenos Aires of all places. So this is kind of as close to a definitive version as you're going to get of this film. And what I like about this version is that the extra footage really kind of fills it out in some interesting ways. Like the plot feels smoother. It makes more sense. Just as a narrative, it makes more sense. And the pace feels a little bit better as well. It's one of those instances where adding footage to a movie actually makes it feel like it moves faster.
Now, what is the nature of this footage that was found in a vault in Buenos Aires? Is this like stuff that just nobody had ever found? Was this stuff who cut this from the movie originally, or how did it get cut out of the movie originally? What's the story with it?
Simple version of it, and it's the only version I really understand myself, is that the film premiered in Berlin. And it was, if not the most expensive film made in Germany at the time, close to it. And it did not do very well. It premiered to much fanfare, but very little audience interest. So before it really played anywhere else, I believe even in Germany, it was pulled from theaters and cut significantly. And what we've seen over the years has been variations on the version that circulated after that, which was much shorter, and then I believe made shorter still for some releases. So this is as close to the original, what you would see on premiere night in Berlin, as we're going to get, I believe. But then who knows? Because people said that in 2002, and suddenly there's a half hour. So maybe there's hours and hours more footage of Metropolis waiting to be seen.
They also restored the diamond smuggling subplot that they cut from the original version, I guess, for time.
Yeah, that was weird. That was weird. And the bumbling comic duo.
I didn't remember. I mean, all the versions that I had seen did not have Mr. Bean in them.
That's true. Or that strange musical number. That was a real shock.
Nathan Rabin, let's talk about this documentary called Best Worst Movie. I met the director the other day. Is this guy named Michael Stevenson, really nice fellow. And he, as a child, was in this movie called Troll 2. In fact, I think we should take a listen to a clip from the documentary Best Worst Movie.
Hi, my name is Michael Paul Stevenson, and 18 years ago, I played the lead role of Joshua in the movie Troll 2.
Neil Bog, his glove is spelled backwards.
I hated this movie. I ran from this film. I wanted nothing to do with it. And then one day, my feelings about this movie changed. Somehow, I ended up as the child star in one of the worst films ever made. That's pretty cool.
So Troll 2 is a movie so spectacularly horrible that it has attracted quite a cult following. And it's interesting to think of the folks who made something so horrible coming back to it. What did you enjoy about watching this documentary with people revisiting what may be the low artistic point in their careers?
Well, I actually watched this before I watched Troll 2, and I wish that the order was reversed, because you watch Troll 2 and you think, my God, how on earth did this film ever get made? I mean, really, there's a sort of cognitive dissonance that somehow this thing exists, which should not exist on any level. There are all sorts of weird incongruities. For one thing, it doesn't actually have anything to do with Troll. It also does not have any actual trolls in it. It's all about goblins. And you think, like, how on earth did this get made? Like, who were the lunatics who made this?
It's actually not a movie. It's a hologram.
Yeah. Really, I mean, like, if you didn't have, like, concrete evidence, you'd think this was, like, some bizarre hallucination. A lot of it's, like, this bizarre anti-vegetarian screed. I guess the screenwriter hated vegetarians. So the bad guys are these goblins, not trolls, it should be noted, who are vegetarians who eat half human, half plant creatures that they create. And no, I'm not the world's foremost expert on vegetarianism or veganism, but I would imagine if something was part human, it probably would qualify as meat. So you wonder, like, oh my God, who are these people? Like, how did this happen? Just this giant question mark. And this answers all of those questions in a really, really satisfying way. And the thing that's amazing is they're all crazier than you would imagine. Like the lead actor, the father, was this dentist. And on one level, he's kind of a normal guy. He never really did a lot of acting outside of Troll 2. It was not, you know, his gateway to starring roles in big studio movies. So on one hand, he's kind of a normal, you know, sort of showboating sort of fellow, but he also has this kind of pathological need for validation and for attention. And they take him to this horror festival, the horror convention. And it's just this really kind of tragicomic scene where he's just kind of like standing there, sitting there, waiting for people to pay attention to him, and they never do. And there's this moment of incredible irony where he's talking about some of the other people there, and he's like, man, can you imagine what that'd be like to just like be basking in the glow of something that you did 20, 25 years ago? And it's like, well, yes, we're watching you right now because that's exactly what you're doing.
Keith, one of your picks is one that I was a little surprised when I saw it because, you know, you tend to be a classy type fella. And your final pick was the complete series on DVD of The $6 Million Man. Now, does The $6 Million Man have anything to teach us, show us, any artistic value, 30 years after, it finished its run?
I think short answer, yes, even if it only applies to me. This was my favorite show when I was 4 or 5. And I mean, I was really into The $6 Million Man. And then as we've seen TV show after TV show reappear on DVD, I kept thinking, you know, I'd like to see The $6 Million Man. Why can't I watch The $6 Million Man? You know, we're 15 years into this DVD thing and there's no $6 Million Man. And suddenly I get a press release for every episode of The $6 Million Man, and I request it. And it's a little overwhelming to revisit it because I find I don't have the patience for the shows I used to enjoy when I was 4. Like my it's not that my attention span has gotten shorter. It's just this thing is paced like you wouldn't believe. Like, I mean, it's just so much footage of just the hero walking around as was the style at the time in 70s TV shows. Well, you know, you couldn't go from one destination to the other without showing the audience every step of the way, usually to the accompaniment of some sort of bongo music. So it's sort of fascinating to revisit. I think as sort of an example of the perils of nostalgia, I think it's a wonderful lesson that perhaps just dipping your toe back into things you used to enjoy is better off doing that than jumping in the deep end.
Let's hear a clip from The $6 Million Man.
Jamie.
Where'd she go?
The back gate's open. She must be headed for town. I've got to stop her.
How much $6 Million Man, having received for free, and I presume, given that you're a member of the media, a complete series box set, did you actually make it through, Keith?
Well, let me get the honest answer at this point is one episode, but I just got it in the mail. So I chose one that seemed like a can't miss. This is going to restore. It's going to remind me of everything I loved about this show. And it was one in which Steve Austin, as played by Lee Majors, who in this episode, as he did in some episodes, has a mustache, a dapper little mustache, goes to an island populated by killer chimps, which you think you can't really mess with that kind of plot description. And yet it involves kind of like sort of the lesser seasons of Lost. So much of this episode involves him walking from one end of the island to the other for seemingly no end. And somehow, despite having killer chimps, there's like one sort of half-hearted fight with a chimp. The rest of it, he's dealing with his friend who's poisoned. And in sort of, as seems sort of inevitable in every 70s action show, at one point someone gets stuck in quicksand. like quicksand is so much more prevalent on 70s television than it is anywhere else in the world, I believe. And here it is yet again. When in doubt, get someone stuck in quicksand. Yeah. Yeah. And one thing I like about this show is that despite his superpowers, like we have certain expectations of superheroes today. Mostly Steve Austin just ends up having to run somewhere quickly or lift something heavy. He's not really taxed beyond that. The limits of the budget, I think kind of put a cap on how amazing his powers could be.
But he's bigger, stronger, faster.
He is. That opening credit sequence is still astoundingly effective.
Nathan, this is the holiday season, so I feel like I can't let this segment go by without letting people know that you have a brand new AV Club branded book out called My Year of Flops. You watched hundreds of movies that were characterized as flops commercially, artistically, and et cetera, and judged whether they deserved their flop status or not. If there was one of these hundreds of movies that you watched that was widely regarded as a flop that you felt deserved your defense, which one would it be?
That is a good question. One that kind of springs to mind is Joe versus the Volcano, which kind of has ambiguous status as a flop. As John Patrick Shanley, who I interviewed for the book, said it actually made back its money, but it opened opposite Pretty Woman. And I think the idea was the movie with Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan, executive produced by Steven Spielberg and directed by the Academy Award-winning screenwriter of Moonstruck, would do very well. And this movie about a prostitute who falls in love and has a heart of gold, starring, you know, Richard Gere in an unknown, would not do so well. And it was actually kind of the reverse. But if you look at it now, Joe versus the Volcano is kind of this sort of life-affirming fable. This incredibly beautifully shot, beautifully written. It really has this kind of fairy tale quality that's utterly beguiling. And I actually didn't like it that much when I saw it the first time, when I was 14 years old. But when I rewatched it for the series, I was enchanted, if I can use a very curly word.
Well, Keith, Nathan, thank you so much for taking the time, as always.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
Yep, thanks.
Nathan Rabin and Keith Phipps are writers and editors at the AV Club. You can find them online at avclub.com. The Sound of Young America is supported in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answer online at ask.metafilter.com. And by Smith Micro Software, makers of Stuff It Deluxe, designed to move files simply and securely wherever customers want them to go. For Mac and PC, online at stuffit.com. Coverage of the world of comedy on The Sound of Young America is supported by Humber College, offering a two-year program dedicated to comedy. Students learn stand-up, improv, acting, and writing skills and perform in the heart of Toronto. At Humber, we make funny people funnier. More information at humbercomedy.com.